John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
My co-host today used to be the Emergency Services Commissioner for Victoria, Bruce Esplin, a man who at times was very much the face of emergency responses right across the state, not just for fires, but floods as well. Now, looking remarkably well, I might say, in his, well, who knows what new roles he's found. Bruce, good morning to you.
Good morning, John. Great to be here.
I didn't know that people could turn back the clock and look younger than they used
can.
To.
I bumped into the Premier about 4 months after, the current Premier, 4 months after he'd taken office and 4 months after I'd, or 6 months after I'd resigned. And he said to me, this is not fair. You look younger and healthier and fitter and I look older and older and older. And I think there's a reality that public office really takes it out of you. If you've seen Steve Brax and others lately, they look incredibly well and healthy. And I think once you unload yourself of that 24/7 stress, it's amazing how quick your health bounces back.
Was health a factor in you deciding you'd had enough?
No, I think it was time for somebody else to have a go. You can't have the same person in a job forever. I was there for 10 years and it was time to move on. And it was also time, in fairness to my wife, to devote some time to our relationship, not be on the phone at night, all night, every night, weekends, visiting communities, visiting CFA, SES and other community bodies. It was an all-consuming role and her tolerance was incredible. But it was also time for me to take up some of my interests, photography and sculpture, which you probably are aware that I've taken up, and to just use some of the experience I've had.
How's your thumb?
Thumb's great. Works really well. I just don't use power tools very often. I use hand tools now. They're a lot less dangerous.
You're going to have to explain.
Well, at a point in time after a particularly stressful week, one Saturday morning, I took an even more stressful telephone call that made me really angry. So I proceeded out to my workshop where I'd been about to start preparing a piece of wood to do a sculpture, and I clamped the piece of wood into a very powerful saw that I had, and there was a very substantial knot in it. The knot caught the blade, ripped the wood out of the clamping arrangement, and took the wood and my thumb and hand into the power saw. Luckily, I had a good power saw that stops as soon as you has a break on it and turns it off as soon as you take your hand off the trigger. But the damage done was the tip of my thumb disappeared, and there was a very substantial cut through tendons and bones in my hand. So, for a period of time, I was very much out of action, and it was a classic example of how stupid men can be when they go out to very powerful tools in their workshop when they're feeling tired and stressed. Good lesson. Don't do it.
I've thought of you often when I've been at the end of the day tired and stressed and doing something with a power tool, and I've thought, this is a Bruce Esplin moment.
It could be.
Just stop.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to get
one more thing done and just finish off and just get this one more little bit
exactly,
of the project done.
Exactly, and that's when it happens, and you wish you'd never done it. So I don't want to hear that you've had the same silliness affect you. So there's a good lesson for all blokes. Don't go and do it. When you're tired, don't go into your power tools.
What sort of a saw? Was it a bandsaw?
No, it was a 12-inch circular saw.
Oh, just a circular saw.
Yeah, so I could have taken, goodness knows what else I could have done. In all seriousness, I'm really lucky. Great surgeon. Everything works. There's no long-term damage to it. The long-term damage is to my sense of worth for doing something so incredibly stupid. But look, I do have the time to do all that now, and you asked what I've been doing. Well,
what's Bruce Esplin up to?
Well, Regional Arts Victoria has been taking up a lot of my time recently. As you, I think you're aware, I'm a director of Regional Arts Victoria on the board there. It's a pro bono, great organisation that does wonderful things to prosecute the interests of arts in regional Victoria.
What does it do?
Well, it acts as a sort of an advocacy body. It connects up government, it connects up arts practitioners, touring parties in regional Victoria. There's an educative arm to it. We take touring arts performances out into schools in regional Victoria. We have a series of regional arts development offices that work across a number of municipalities in four parts of the state, and they act as a sort of a connection point for artists in those communities, for touring, for theatre. We run leadership. We had a fabulous creative leadership program a few weeks ago where we brought very young arts leaders from regional Victoria to 10 days in Melbourne, put them through an intense training course. All the big art institutions in Melbourne provided a day of internship, basically, so we could put these young arts leaders into roles with the Recital Centre or the National Gallery or Malthouse, and they got a tremendous experience of what it was like to be an arts administrator. They're taking that back into their community. So on the board of...
So they kind of came and saw the big league, big professional...
And they got to speak in a very small group to some of the real agents of influence in arts in Victoria, and then they take that knowledge back into their own communities and hopefully into not only their own arts practice but also into their ability to be the future very senior arts managers. So Lindy Allen's been our CEO for a long period of time, done just an amazing job, really fantastic job, but as is the way with these things, she got to a point where another really exciting opportunity came along, and Lindy has resigned from Regional Arts Victoria to take up the role as a national program producer working with Robin Archer for the centenary of Canberra, which is a fabulous opportunity for her, and it's a return to a more creative rather than a leadership and management role. So we've had to find a new CEO. So Esther Anotolides, who's the current Chief Executive Officer of Melbourne Fringe, has been the person who got through our grueling selection process, and she'll take up the role in a probably a month or so. So Esther will build on the fantastic work of Lindy, but she'll take it in a different direction, which is good and healthy, and it's about renewal. So it's an exciting time, but that's taken up a lot of time. Recently been invited to join the board of Green Cross Australia, which was...
Green Cross?
Yeah, it's an organisation established internationally by Mikhail Gorbachev, believe it or not, and it's about toughening up communities to deal with the sorts of stresses and reverses that seem to be happening all around the world. While it has a focus on environmental sustainability, but the board's made up of quite an incredibly good mix of people. So high-profile business leaders, CSIRO, professors from academia.
So it's like the Red Cross, but for the environment?
Sort of, but it's about giving communities a voice. So it's not pushing an agenda of whether climate change is man-made or whatever. It's about creating the space where communities can do so much to help themselves. So one of the really successful programs they've run recently is a program called Harden Up, which is about when there's a disaster, don't just build it back as it was, build it back stronger and tougher and better so that it's more resilient next time the disaster happens, and it will. And I think that's what's been missing in Australia. When there's a disaster, the intent and the challenge for politicians is to be seen to be replacing what was there. The reality is we should be not replacing, but building better and stronger and tougher. And we should be asking the community for their views on how to do that. And that's what Green Cross is about.
Well, it's interesting. I really like the idea that there are people who notionally, and I know you don't like the R word, retire, but people who move away from a high-profile public position, whether it's in politics or in public administration or whatever it might be, but then continue to work for the benefit of the community as they've got so much still to offer. And you're a classic example of that, as we see.
John, since I resigned, I've met the most incredible young people. And if my experiences can be a factor that they include in the way they do what they're doing, then I'm really happy to provide that. And I think there are so many wonderful people that are available that just can't be connected up in the right places. Now, I'm lucky because I had a job that had a bit of a profile. So I can talk about the role of arts in communities. I can talk about...
Make some of those links.
Firefoxes today and make those links. But I think it'd be wonderful if we could connect up some of the other people that maybe are willing to do it, but they just don't know how to go about doing it.
And you're such a young man too.
Well, I am. I'd like to think I am. I dress like it. You know, still a teenager at heart, as are you.
I'm glad your hair's growing back. On the conversation now, Bruce Esplin, former Emergency Services Commissioner, my co-host. Our first guest in just a moment, the best-selling author and, well, how do you describe Kathy Lett in a nutshell? Well, she's a whirlwind. She's a machine. She not only writes and talks in rapid, fast-forward sort of mode, but the ideas come thick and fast as well. And
Somebody's glaring at you through the window.
Good. Kathy Lett is my first guest, but this book that brings her back to our studio is written from a quite different experience and perspective, because she has written in part from the heart about her own experience as the parent of a child with Asperger's, and her book is about a mother of a child with autism. So it's still funny, it's still controversial, It still makes you laugh and squirm from time to time, but it's got a lot of heart in it as well. And Kathy Lett, our first guest on the Conversation Hour in just a moment.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Kathy Lett writes books and she makes you laugh. She lives life in the fast lane. But now we get a little sneak peek behind the scenes in her new novel, which still makes you laugh, but it also has a lot of heart in it. It's called The Boy Who Fell to Earth, and it's about a single mum who falls, well, it's a young woman who falls in love with a man of an upper class out of her league, and everything's going swimmingly until they find out that their firstborn has a disability. Kathy, welcome back to the Conversation Hour.
Hello.
And there's a lot of heart in this book, and you tell us about the standard stages of response that I suspect is somewhat autobiographical about what happens when you're told about your child.
Well, I'm finally coming out about the fact that I do have a son with Asperger's, which I've never talked about before because I didn't want to invade his privacy. But, you know, now that he's 21, with his blessing, I am talking about it for the first time. And the book's had an amazing impact already. I've had so many letters from other mothers particularly saying that I've put into words what they're going through, what they've been through and what life's like for them and what a relief that is. And I've tried to do it with humour. I've tried to make the book a celebration of idiosyncrasies and eccentricities and being different. Mm. But it is true, when you do get the diagnosis, to answer your question, Julius was 3 when we were told he had autism, and it's like a cold knife plunged into your heart, because that's a diagnosis that just drags you into the dark.
First response you say was denial. Anger came next. Stage 3, a bad case of the why me's.
The why me's, of course. Yes, you do. You feel victimised. And then you sort of, first of all, you as a mother, your guilt gland throbs so strongly. You think, was it something I ate? Was it something I didn't eat? Should I have had the pureed beetroot like Gwyneth Paltrow and Organic Co? Or was it that one glass of wine I drank?
How do you deal with it?
It's just a stage.
Pureed beetroot, I agree. How does anyone deal?
It's just a stage. The next stage is trying to get a new diagnosis, and you bankrupt yourself seeing every specialist in the whole wide world. I hate to think how many private doctors' children I've now put through university. But then after a while, you just have to accept that you have this unique person. I don't think there's anything such as sort of normal and abnormal. I think there's ordinary and extraordinary. And they are extraordinary little people, and you just try and bring out the best in them. But of course, with the cutbacks, especially in Britain, people with less sort of obvious disabilities like Asperger's and autism are losing out in the scramble for funds. Mm. But if we can help these young people with early educational intervention, they can go on to contribute to society in the most incredible way. Because we now know with diagnostic hindsight that people like Mozart, Einstein, Van Gogh, Andy Warhol, you know, H.G. Wells, Newton were all on the autistic spectrum. So,
In fact, other people in public life, either undiagnosed or secretly diagnosed, we could probably rattle off a roll call of high achievers who could well fall within the spectrum
as well. Steve Jobs, there's a typical example. In fact, I would say a lot of scientists, I mean, Canberra must be full of undiagnosed autistic men, and politicians who just monologue at you and never listen. Yeah. And I also, when I've been on tour in Britain, I've been saying to women in the audience, just think about your husband for a minute. Is he emotionally inarticulate? Is he socially awkward?
Sorry, is there anyone who doesn't answer that one? Yeah.
You know, is he a train spotter? Is he obsessed with planes or catalogues?
Does he restore wooden Citroën frames?
I don't know. Is that you? Is that you, John?
I'm just restoring an odd car. That's not.
Oh no, no. John's the opposite of autistic. He's totally emotionally articulate. You are, darling. You are. You are.
I mean, why else would he be sitting in that? That's 2 compliments he's had in 10 minutes.
Yeah,
that's
don't worry,
too much.
I'll slap him down.
Stop
in a minute.
It.
But so the women are sitting there
Introduce
nodding.
Introduce you to my wife if you're not careful.
Well, she's trained you well.
Yeah, right.
But the women in the audience sit there nodding. And even my own darling dad, who died in January so sadly, but I remember once my mum and dad had a terrible fight and my mother was turning her back to him in bed and serving his meals in silence. And I have 3 sisters. I was about 13 and we were all tiptoeing around the house, you know, on eggshells. It was terrible. And by the end of the week, my mum said to my dad, oh, Mervy, his name was Mervyn. He worked in optic fibre. We called him Optic Merv. Oh, Mervy, I just can't bear anymore. We've just got to make up. And I remember he just looked at her and said, what? He hadn't noticed. And I don't think that's untypical, actually, you know. So So, yeah, there is a, one in every 100 people is on the autistic spectrum. So there's a lot of it.
Are you saying your father was on the autistic spectrum?
No, he wasn't. He's just male. I think all men are on the spectrum somewhere.
Of course
you
we
guys
are
at the high functioning end, but yeah. But, you know, so it's been very cathartic to write the book. I didn't mean to write it. I started writing another book about the sex war, which is my usual genre, and this other book just started pouring out of the end of my pen. And
so you needed to tell us.
I did. I needed to write it.
And when you talk to
yourself...
The book's
about the sex war too, though, isn't it?
It is.
Inevitably. The male reaction.
Oh, right. I made the mother, the protagonist, I made her a single mother because it is very typical that the husband bails out. I mean, a lot of people with the parents of special needs, the father, you know, just can't tolerate the situation and disappears. But it's also, I made her a single mother because it's very socially isolating when you have a child with special needs. People judge you when you're at the playground. I call the sandbox the quick sandbox because if your child does something slightly eccentric, other parents glare at you and pull their children away as though, you know, he's got leprosy and it might be contagious.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, even now when my son's older, or when all your friends' children are going to Harvard and Oxford and Sydney University and they're climbing Mount Everest and they're doing work experience at Vogue and in top barristers' chambers, it's like being at an amazing banquet, you know, with incredible aromas wafting out and you're just sort of starving outside. It can be very isolating. But I don't mean to sound bleak because it also can be so fabulously funny and interesting because I don't know if you guys know anyone with Asperger's, but they have no social, they have no filter. They say exactly what they're thinking, which can be really
totally
liberating. Yes. And, you know, so like I'll try and think of some examples that might amuse you. Once I had a very famous actor. I'm going to say his name even though it sounds like I'm going for gold in the name dropping Olympics because then you'll understand the true horror of the scenario. I had Hugh Jackman over for dinner.
Oh,
now, women love him. Who doesn't, though? Yeah. I mean, he's the top ingredient on our human menu. We adore him. So I'm flirting for Australia. I mean, in my mind, we've already eloped and we're living in the Caribbean, right? And then my son came home, Jules. He was about 13 at the time. And he walked and I jumped up and hugged him and said, oh, hi, Jules. And I said, oh, look, darling, you're growing a moustache. And he just scrutinised me and said, well, so are you, Mum. He said, look at all those hairs on your top lip. He said, you've got quite a few on your chin as well. And I'm like, you know, is it too late to put him back in the condom vending machine for the refund? So, and, you know, and it can be dangerous sometimes too because we were walking along a road one day and this big hairy biker came towards us. I can't remember if I used this in the book, but this big guy had tattoos and piercings. It was really scary. And I'm thinking, oh, we'll just scurry past quietly. And my son, who was about 14, stopped him, pulled on his sleeve and said, excuse me, but has anyone ever told you that your chin looks like upside-down testicles? And I'm like, who is this child and why is he calling me mother? You know, run. So and
no, you
and,
weren't. You were pulling out your notebook and writing it down saying, that would be great in the book.
And because of their very lateral, literal logic, their very tangential intelligence, one day I said to him, I was going out, and I said, Jules, I'm going out. If you pop out, he was probably about 15, I said, can you lock the doors so the burglars don't steal my jewellery? And when I got home, doors open, he's out. And I said to him later, why didn't you lock the door? And he said, why would men want jewellery? There's a weird logic there, isn't there? So it makes you incredibly overprotective. I mean, the other part of the book that I wanted to emphasise is that it's the story about the mother learning to let the child go. Because every time my
son... Not overprotecting.
Yes. And every time my son leaves
home... helicopter parents.
Yeah. And it's imagine what it's like when you have a child who's fragile. Every time he goes out, you'd think he was immigrating. The amount of notes and hugs and goodbyes and lists of phone numbers and all that. But how are you ever going to know if your child can cope in the outside world if you don't let him into it? So it's a lot about her letting to let go. But I want to stress too, the book's not just for people who have a child on the spectrum or someone with special needs. It's also, it's a love story.
There's the usual gags. There's the usual gags.
Usual gags?
Well, we depend upon you for them and they come thick and fast and they're as good as ever. Save your breath, Archibald. You'll need it to inflate your next girlfriend. I just love that. I ran the highlighter pen through that.
Glad.
But when you talked to Julius about the fact that you were going to write this book and therefore you'd be talking about him, what did he think? What did he say?
Well, when I realised this was the book that was pouring out of me, I thought, well, look, I won't tell anyone it's based on personal experience. I'll just let the book stand on its own two literary legs because, as I said, said I didn't want to invade his privacy. But then a journalist asked me at Christmas time, I was in Sydney, if it was true I had a child on the autistic spectrum. And I thought, well, I'm not going to lie. If I lie, it looks as though I'm embarrassed of him. And the opposite is true. I'm so proud of him. So I asked him, he's 21, and he loves the book. He thinks it helps destigmatize the whole condition.
Is he in London or Australia?
In London, right. Yeah.
Because you kind of divide your time.
Yeah, we sort of straddle hemispheres, darling, and my favourite position. But I asked him what he thought about me coming out in public about our relationship and about his condition. And he just thinks anything that can help people be less judgmental and more understanding. Because these people with Asperger's, they are so highly intelligent. Their IQ is so strong. And yet because of their quirks, they often don't fit into mainstream life. But if we were more accepting, they as I said, they could contribute in the most interesting way.
You also make the point that it doesn't mean that the person's a genius, that there's a spread of effect and an impact. And I think it's too easy for us to want to compartmentalise everybody into just a black and white little box and you're all or nothing
rather than the spread. I mean, for example, my son is Wikipedia with a pulse. I mean, I don't even have a diary. I say, where was I on the 3rd of June 2002? And he will know. He will tell me. And yet he can't get the right change from the corner store. So it's very sort of extreme. But the way they think is fascinating. And when he was about 5, I remember him saying to me, he said, Mum, what's the speed of dark? Now, what a great question.
Yeah. Were all those questions? There's so many wonderful. They're all his?
Mostly his. I mean, normally when you're doing research, you have to climb, you know, the Himalayas or go down the Amazon or something. I would just go next door to my office and knock on my son's bedroom and say, what would you say now in this situation?
Like how? When does a spy know if he's out of invisible ink?
All that stuff. Yeah, I remember I was chopping onions one day and he said, Mum, if onions make you cry, are there vegetables that make you happy? Now, another great question, isn't it?
Yep.
So once you come to accept their quirks, it can be very rewarding.
Well, there's a view that everybody's on the autism spectrum. It's just some people are more, it's more visible and more apparent.
Yes, especially
and that we all have somewhere in us certain aspects of it and traits. It's just for most of us, we manage to control it, mask it, manage it in daily life.
Yeah.
There is that view.
I mean, it's very hard to educate kids with Asperger's because I think putting a kid with Asperger's in a mainstream school is as effective as giving a fish a bath.
Mm.
I mean, most kids at school strive to learn math and grammar. Kids with special needs strive to make themselves invisible. Especially, you know, because of this idea of mainstreaming kids with special needs, often the poor teacher is, especially in the inner cities, is dealing with kids who don't have English as a first language. Then they've got all the special needs kids, whether they've got Fragile X or Asperger's or whatever. And then they've got their helpers often. So you can have like 40 people in one classroom. I mean, a sardine would feel claustrophobic in there. And it just doesn't really work.
But kids are by nature cruel.
So cruel, putting signs on. My son once came home with a sign on his back saying, kick me, I'm a retard. And your heart just breaks, So I just think they have to have special schools and then hopefully they can give back to us.
But not special schools there's a sort of an almost a prejudice against special schools that automatically connotates something that you don't want it to be. And it's a special school, but it's not the old school definition of a special school, I'm making myself unclear.
Yeah, just somewhere where they won't be put on detention for asking the headmaster what he puts on his driver's license where it says hair colour is he's completely bald.
Yeah.
Or asks him, you know, how does he get up in the morning when your penis always makes you want to touch it? Things like that, for which kids with Asperger's are always getting into terrible trouble. But they're not trying to be rude.
No, they're just saying what they think, which is what has always been your trademark.
You think I've got, maybe I'm on the spectrum.
But it has been.
Yes, I suppose it has in a way. I mean, I always say I just write down the way women talk when there's no men around. And because I'm sort of gutsy. So I don't know whether it's really Asperger's or just having, you know, iron labia, not balls of steel. We can't say that, whatever the female version is. But, yes, I am very candid. That's true. So perhaps
a really serious issue. I mean, I got the book couriered out to me yesterday afternoon, and as I said to you, I ended up finishing the book at 12:45, which is because I really got stuck into it. It just grabbed me. It made me laugh. It made me not cry, but it certainly tugged some strings that males don't like having tugged. but you got a lot of messages in there in a way that I think will penetrate sometimes the walls that we set around ourselves because we don't want to know because it's too confronting. But you've made it humorous, you've made it funny, and it gets through and people have to confront the all of those issues.
Thank you. I'm so glad.
I don't understand, though, Kathy, one other thing, just before we introduce our next guest to the conversation now today. You say that when your child's diagnosed as having special needs, it requires that extra commitment, and yet your husband, Jeffrey Robertson, and yourself have both maintained this extraordinarily productive career, each of you independently of each other, as well as what we regularly see as a very active social life. How do you juggle all of that and yet still meet the needs of a child with a disability along with your other kids?
I obviously hire someone to sleep, eat and have sex for me. You know, I have stand-ins. No, I think the thing is, too, when you have a child with special needs, it's very easy to go into martyr mode. And I would say to any parent out there, live your own life as well. Otherwise, you could resent all the time you have to give them. So, and also it teaches you to seize joy wherever you can. I mean, the reason you often see me swinging from a chandelier at a party or, you know, just being mad and wild and wonderful is that a lot of your life can be quite dark and harrowing. So I just say have fun wherever you can. And it's a good lesson for life anyway, you know, carpe diem, etc. And carpe dieming away there.
That's a really beautiful connection to the next guest because that notion of normalcy, what is normal, what's not, and being able to go back in time, all these things are going to connect up with what we're going to talk about in a minute, but also the relationship element that you stress in the book, just the impact it can have on a relationship, getting that that first diagnosis from a specialist.
Yeah. Kathy, not a hint of exploitation in this book. It's a good fun romp, but dealing with some very important issues. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
The Boy Who Fell to Earth, the latest novel from Kathy Lett. The Boy Who Fell to Earth. It's published by Bantam Press. It's in paperback. It's in the shops now. Joining us in a moment, two firefoxes, Jemima Richards and Kate Riddell, are two of the women who have taken on a leadership role in the recovery of communities affected by bushfires in Victoria. How do you do that? How do you meet the challenge? And why is it women that end up doing this? There's a few answers to some of the questions we've been dealing with already, I suspect, still to come on the conversation now.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
We're joined by Kate and Jemima. Jemima Richards and Kate Riddell are firefoxes. Their T-shirts tell me so. They're here to tell us the story of how women have taken on the leadership role in recovery in bushfire-affected communities. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Hello. Thanks for having us.
Why firefoxes?
Why not? Firefoxes. It came about after the fires where we saw how differently men and women were handling the trauma after being involved in the bushfires.
And how were they differently handling it?
They were...
Come on, dish it out.
Men were doing what men do best. They were fixing things, going back into their cave and getting their tools out and wanting to rebuild stuff. And women were wanting to gather and talk and look after each other and see what needed to be done. And for some women in our community, that was actually the first time they had come out of their shell to be involved.
And what we saw was that the women, in fact, needed to have a little bit more support than what they were having, because we knew that if the women were okay, then by extension, the men and the children and the rest of the community would be okay.
And on it flows from there. Blokes like to make themselves busy.
Busy doing, busy fixing.
Men do that because they don't want to talk. No. They think that talking about what they've been through is a sign of weakness. And I first met these wonderful women, and I think they were self-described as a stay-at-home mum and somebody that ran a small business in the nearby area. And as so often happens in disasters and in the recovery phase, leaders pop up who are not necessarily part of the existing structure of a community.
But don't you reckon blokes don't mind talking about how busy they are?
Yes.
For sure.
Just not about their feet.
No, John, after disasters, they don't even do that.
Really?
They don't connect. And they don't connect, and the trauma that they've been through just festers inside. Mm. They don't talk about it, and then when it pops up as domestic violence or suicide or a total inability to cope and are running away. Now, what the girls have done, and from two people who didn't do any public speaking to two people who are wonderful communicators, as they've now become, they've become champions and they've become leaders, and their story is so important for communities to realise because it encourages people to talk. And if the women in a family, in a community are healthy, the children will be healthy and hopefully the men will be healthier and the opportunity will present. And this is such an important piece of work, and it builds on Kathy's notion of normalcy. And I think that's the whole thrust.
Going to say two things. First, the thing about men not talking. When my son was about six, he said to me, he loved Shakespeare, and he said to me, if Macbeth had a talking doctor, he wouldn't have killed Duncan. And I thought, that's absolutely true. But also this thing about women coming up in the community, I think especially Australian women, the camaraderie and the sisterliness we have. I mean, Australian women are each other's human wonder bras, uplifting, supportive, and making each other look bigger and better, which is what you two have done in the community, and really, really well, well done.
Absolutely. We've been so blessed to be surrounded by some incredible women and men who have supported us in this journey and who have guided us and who have, I guess, led us in directions that we never thought may have been possible. And what we've seen come out of that is communities that are healthier and more connected, and that's so important after natural disaster or any kind of trauma or life-changing event.
I should point to the fact there's a video which has been funded by the Women's Trust called Creating a New Normal, which is about the fire foxes, Creating a New Normal. It's available through the Women's Trust. And there's a conversation. I mean, the structure of the video is very simple. It's a dinner party and you're sitting around. There's, what, six or seven of you sitting around.
That's a bit of it, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's cutaways and little bits to expand upon it. That's the spine of the film.
Narrative.
And there's a conversation within it that I've never heard anyone publicly have before, which is where you talk about the hierarchy of victimhood and deservedness.
Yeah.
Oh, well, and it's the woman with the stud in her nose. What's her name?
Bron.
Bron. She's a star.
And, she's great.
And she's saying how angry it makes her when someone says, well, I lost a relative, so I'm more deserving than you because you only lost a house. Yeah, well, I lost two members of my family, so I'm more deserving than you. And there's that.
It's a competition that no one really wants to win, isn't it?
No, exactly. It's like the Monty Python sketch, you know, about, oh, well, I live in a cardboard box. Oh, well, I live in, a fettered, dog turd or whatever. It's the same thing.
And that happened right across Victoria. It's happened in Queensland. Thanks to Westpac, Kate and I have been talking up through the flood-affected areas and the cyclone-affected areas. And exactly the same thing's happening. And what we saw happen immediately after the fires was our town coming together in this real Anzac spirit of we won't be beaten by this and we will get through this. And then as time goes on and what we now understand is the traumatic recovery experience, there are certain timelines in the recovery that is actually part of.
And people get angry.
People get angry and it divides the community and it's trying to bring the community back together. But we now know that response is part of recovering from being involved in a trauma. Mm-hmm. And it's now trying to focus on what is the good in our community and how we strengthen that and how we strengthen our community to make it more resilient for whatever else happens in the future.
And with any grief experience, different people move along that line different progressions.
Absolutely.
At different rates.
And we just can't emphasise enough the importance of storytelling. So when I listen to your story and you listen to my story and we have a shared understanding that we are all on this journey together and it's different but it's similar at the same time, that's where some of those barriers are broken down and we're able to get on with the job of making sure that we're well and happy and healthy and so are our communities.
Can I ask a question? It'd be my experience that right now is a pretty difficult time for the people from Black Saturday because there's been a lot of other disasters around the world and in Victoria and floods and certainly in Australia. And it's a time when a lot of the resources are moving away, the government support, community support, NGO support. It's a time more than ever where the work that you've started and you're continuing to do, not only in Victoria but in Queensland, it's more important now than ever that it continues because there's all sorts of reports in the media recently. You might want to raise that issue of events that happen in a community that are perhaps initially judged to be caused by a disaster when in fact it may be something different. So I'd be interested in your views on that particularly, but we've got to keep providing support to communities. It's not over.
Absolutely.
Far from it.
Look, the recovery journey is a very long and slow and complex journey. And, it's sometimes difficult to understand where the recovery journey stops and the community rebuilding starts because our community will continue to want to strengthen and be healthy and need to do things around that. And I think what you were referring to, we've had a number of very tragic suicides in the community recently. And it's complex situation. And for a number of those people, as with other communities that have suffered trauma, that those people had pre-existing mental health issues and had struggles before that. And rather than the natural disaster being the cause, it was more the tipper. And I think that any kind of ongoing support around mental health and community development in any community is healthy, and we encourage and support that to, you know, the agencies and the people helping us out to stick around.
And we encourage it in a different format too, because there is mainstream traditional psychiatric care. There's also other services, like an incredible program that's running in Kinglake called Horses for Hope, which is based around the Horse Whisperer program. Mm-hmm. And that was brought to Kinglake to get the men engaged in not having to talk about their feelings, but actually utilise the horse as the tool. We're big advocates for emotional self-care. So for some people, it's another lot of services like reflexology and Chinese medicine and kinesiology and things that work. Mm. And we share these experiences when we're talking, because for me, my personal journey was seeing the trauma counsellor was the most traumatic experience of my life.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
That was my experience. Whereas for other people, it's what has saved their life. Mm. So when we're talking about these things in terms of recovery, we'd like to think that, you know, in the future that we can have a voice as an organisation collectively to give some ideas of other things that have worked for our recovery and that they can support rather than just go the mainstream traditional avenues.
What I love about you both is that you don't think optimism is an eye disease. And that's the real thing you have to fight is pessimism.
Absolutely.
And Australians, we do have that wonderful kind of positivity. We in London, after the bushfires, Jessica Rudd and I organised the bushfire memorial service. Mm-hmm. And being Aussies, we thought we'd start. I thought we'd get a little church in Earls Court. We started at the top. Jess rang Westminster Abbey, and we got Westminster Abbey.
Fabulous.
And we had a huge fundraising there, and it was the biggest fundraising event they'd ever had, biggest memorial service. They raised more money. We had more people. Every Australian in Britain, I think, came to this event and
the
just wanted to give back.
The outpouring of generosity has been incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people have said to us, to Kate Nye, other women in the organisation, gee, how do you stay so upbeat, or how do you remain so happy? And what if someone wants to come along to a dinner and they're not in the place that you are? And we say, make no mistake, we have had our bad days, our bad months, but we recognise when they are and we recognise how we best manage them. But also, what we've been through has been hideous. And if we could have our time again, we would take it back in a heartbeat. And people would say to us, are you back to normal yet? And that's where the creating a new normal came from, because we would say we will never be back to who we were on February 6th, but we're hell-bent on creating a new one. Mm-hmm. And the only way we can do that is to acknowledge what's happened, accept the tragedy, understand that there'll be gaps and mistakes made, and figure out how how we as a community can contribute to what we know needs to happen.
Okay, so the new you is different.
Yes.
And maybe better.
Yes. In ways.
Look, it's been a great opportunity to do some reflection on the things that were great before in your life and really value that, but also an opportunity to dream big and to bring those things that were perhaps pie in the sky stuff, or I'll get round to that on a rainy day. Well, our rainy day came
and it's pushed you out of your comfort zone, hasn't
Absolutely.
You? It's turned your life upside down, and look what's emerged. Yeah. It's a bit like the bush. Look what grows back.
Yeah, yes. And it's drawn out. It's what it has. It's drawn out the strengths that I think we realised that we had in us, but we just never knew how to utilise them to the best of our ability, perhaps.
And people have said to us, you know, you must have been doing this sort of stuff for a very long time. And we said, look, we've never, ever done anything like this in our lives.
So what were you before
the fires? But we feel like we've been preparing for it.
Professionally, what did you
do? Which is the stay-at-home?
I'm a stay-at-home mum. I was a lighthouse keeper. I was a school teacher. I've done a lot of
But, you know, you shouldn't – I don't think you ever should say you're a stay-at-home mum. You should say you're the president of in-home pedagogy.
That's
or a domestic engineer and get more respect.
But the most challenging and wonderful experience of my life.
Still, you're missing on some of the skills and some of the background you've got. And I think we were talking earlier today about the value of people participating in outdoor activity, and you've got a skill in that direction and a professional qualification, and you've taken the things that have created the Kate Riddell on the 6th of February and turned them into something much bigger, much better, much more sharing, not just in Victoria but around Australia. And I think that's such a great thing to do, such an important thing, John. We were talking about getting people that have had experience and not just pushing them out into the back paddock, but about enabling people and their experiences to be part of shaping a future. And I've had some discussions with Firefoxes and some other communities that I know that are doing the most amazing work to make themselves strong. Not much government help, just doing it because they know how, and they're getting local support. Now, I'd really like to pull all these little groups together, and we talked about it earlier, and start to understand how it happens. How do leaders emerge in a community, and how does government get out of the way and let the leaders emerge and not handicap their work?
I think just it's not facilitate out of the way. Their work. Yeah, support what's there, support yeah, what
but
they
don't,
see.
Don't create don't, a uniform yeah. shade of grey across
That's
the whole
exactly
of the state.
Right.
And it's such an important message that, you know, for everyone out there listening who thinks that we are something extraordinary. We're actually just ordinary women who have chosen to, you know, step up and do something in our community. And everybody's capable of that. Everybody has a special skill or a talent that they may not recognise, and that we say get out there and utilise that and embrace that and celebrate that for the good of yourself and for the good of the community.
You are doing special things, though. You've got a DVD about you, and I think, John, the point that needs to be stressed there is the DVD is purposefully available to everybody for nothing, so that your experience, what you've done is a tool that's available to other people
Absolutely.
Anywhere in
yeah.
the world.
People can go to firefoxes.org.au and get that. And if they wanted a hard copy, people at the Women's Trust are standing by on the phones and at women@vwt.org.au, and $5 covers a hard copy if you're interested in getting one of those.
And it's just storytelling. It's storytelling about what has made our recovery easier, harder, what we would do again if we had our time. And to
it's
know
a conversation
that
starter.
To know that people in Queensland have already seen it and have the feedback we've had from that, and feedback from other people who aren't naturally disaster affected but have just had a trauma or something change their life. Mm-hmm. So this DVD is not just about natural disaster. It's about anything that changes the course of your life that finds you creating a new normal.
Mm. John, if you link up Kathy's story and what Firefoxes have done, there are a lot of parallels. There's about the spread of normalcy, that it's not just a little box that everybody does or doesn't fit into. It's about the effect on relationships. It's about realising who's perhaps stronger in a relationship, who talks more, who starts the recovery period earlier than the other gender.
That's right.
There's a whole lot of appropriate links in what you've collectively done.
Thank you. But it's also about drawing strength from adversity, because I think I speak for all the parents of special needs children. It teaches you. It improves you. It
Absolutely.
Teaches you to be less judgmental. It
Absolutely.
Makes you more humble
yep.
and more thankful. And all those are very positive strengths and positive attributes. And I'm sure you've found the same with
we
your
have.
Experience.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Kathy, there's a moral imperative. When we're confronted by an individual tragedy in a family or a collective tragedy in a community or a state or a country, I think to learn from it, and the lives lost and the property damaged is in vain if there's no improvement. And I think the sort of work that is being done, whether it's in relation to people with special needs or whether it's in relation to dealing with a mass disaster, we've got to learn to do it better. We can, but the stories can't afford to be lost in the mists of time 2 years after they happen.
And that's why we did the recording. We wanted the legacy to be the information that we had learnt, because when we had spoken to people that had gone before us in natural disasters, from Bali bombings and the tsunamis, they were telling us the same story that we were experiencing. So we're saying, hang on a second, if you're saying that, we're saying that. What about the people in the future that can learn from it?
And none of us know what's going to happen
next,
in our lives
exactly.
tomorrow.
Exactly.
And people cruise. I mean, there are people who cruise through life and nothing ever goes wrong, and good luck to them. That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
But if you are one of those people, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, whether it's your health diagnosis or your car crash or whatever it might be. I met a bloke the other night who was a very high-flying professional and had just come out of a year's rehab after a car crash, left him with a brain injury. And it was that classic thing. You're cruising along and life's fantastic on every level, personally, professionally, everything fabulous. And then literally...
in a moment.
Bang! In a moment. And now suddenly he's very interested in the National Disability Insurance.
Yeah. But it's about also learning to strap a big shock absorber to your brain, isn't it? And the way you do that is by sharing stories and realising you're not alone. You know, if you know that other people have gone through the same thing and you can draw strength from that, you can sort of shore yourself up against pain.
It's amazing you say that, because when we talk in Queensland, we've been up there talking to the communities about just telling the stories about what's happened back home and things that have been really beneficial and, you know, just all the different bits, men, children, insurance, all those sorts of things. And people come up to us without fail every time, and some of them will be quite tearful. Some will be saying, I feel like you are telling my story. Mm-hmm. And we, Kate and I, look at these women and these men in the audiences and we recognise ourselves at that same moment in the timeline.
It's funny,
it's like looking in the mirror and we can see the shock, the disbelief, the all of it now. Yeah. Whereas and we couldn't see it in ourselves back then.
I'm getting it from this book. Two women just came up saying, you have told my story.
Yes.
And the relief they have that someone has articulated it for them.
Yeah.
And so they can just pass it
to... don't feel so alone.
You don't feel so alone.
You don't feel so alone. You feel like you're going crazy. You know, it's a real comforting thing to feel like you belong.
You've touched on one of the really big points, I think, and that is there's a view in our society, and I think we're more vulnerable. I'd argue that we're really more vulnerable as a community because we all think it won't happen to me.
Oh, for sure.
And it will, and it does. And if we collectively could have that thinking just changed a little bit to recognise that it is possible, it will happen,
then
we'd be a much stronger community than we are now.
It might happen to anyone.
Yeah. Exactly.
And we should be very, very aware that even if it doesn't happen to you, it could. And you should understand that when something bad happens, it's not because people deserve it or were asking. That judgmental stuff really does kick in.
Mm.
It's not because people did something wrong. It's just life happens. Look, congratulations.
Thank you.
This is a free download off the internet. And the website once more, Jemima, is...
www.firefoxes.org.au.
So just put Firefoxes
in.
And off you go. And if you want a physical, actual DVD,
there's
$5 to cover the creation of it and the postage, and you go to the Women's Trust. And it's been funded by an anonymous donor, I noticed, in the credits.
Yeah, the Women's Trust, they were 100% behind this project and they sourced the donor, the anonymous donor, who believed in this and felt that it needed to be captured.
So yet again, anonymous, very well done. Very well done. Jemima Richards and Kate Riddell, two of the Firefoxes, and the DVD's available free as a download from firefoxes.org.au, or if you want a physical copy, you get it for $5 from the Women's Trust. Kathy Lett is here to tell us about her new book, The Boy Who Fell to Earth, which has just been published, which brings her to the studio with Bruce Esplin, formerly Victoria's Emergency Services Commissioner. My co-host, thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.